Welcome to Theatre Voice. Anastasia Hilly is well known in theatre and on television, most recently The Missing. On stage, she's played many leading roles, both in new plays and classics, from Greek tragedy to Ibsen and, of course, Shakespeare. She's been Rosalind at the Globe, Hermione for the RSC, Lady Macbeth for Cheek by Jowl, and last year she played Gertrude opposite Benedict Cumberbatch's Hamlet. But just now she's Titania and Hippolyta in Joe Hill Gibbons' mud-splattered production of A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Young Vic. My name's Heather Neal, and I'm joined by Anastasia at the Young Vic before a performance. So thank you very much for finding time to do this between things today. Can we just say something about the practicalities of being in this production? Because the set, we should explain, is a sort of semicircular arena of mud, isn't it? And you're on stage throughout. You don't leave at all, even though you're doubling. So, first of all, moving in this mud, it looks quite difficult, is it?
Well, its preferred name is stage soil.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Rather than mud, but yes, it's definitely challenging. We had an opportunity to work with it during rehearsals anyway, so we had a sort of small pit which we could play around and experiment, because obviously walking, moving, and generally standing even is quite challenging, because it's not, we found, for example, if you stand in it, you sink gradually and you could be 6 inches deep by the time you've decided to move again. So it's own energy and quality, and it has quite an impact on everything you do. I personally find I really enjoy working in it, because it's very literally grounding. It's very unpredictable, so you have to be sort of on your toes, literally. You have to really be able to adapt constantly, and there's never a sort of safety feeling of stand and deliver. You have to constantly be adjusting your position, and
so that you don't sink.
So, well, not really that you don't sink, because once you're in, that's fine. It's just that you have to, you're never sure if you're walking from A to B, just a gentle, you know, gesture that you're making towards someone, or you choose to run even, whether you're going to get there in the way that you predicted.
Yeah.
So you're constantly having to be right in the moment to get where you need to be. So it has a really positive impact, actually, which is that's all we're trying to do, is trying to be in the moment, to be alive. And because it is a living substance, it's unpredictable, it sort of forces you into the present all the time. So that's his big bonus.
Mm.
But it does, you know, we had chances to work with it before. We had a whole week, actually, before we opened, really playing in it, and found a lot more that you can do in it. And in a way, that's still evolving, because it's just not like anything else you ever work with. So you can throw yourself on it. It's lined, so it's slightly bouncy as well. So you can throw yourself down on it. You can really, you know, it's quite acrobatic, things can happen on it, which is really exciting. I mean, you're not going to hurt yourself if you land sort of awkwardly. It just absorbs everything. So
quite a lot of it gets on the clothing as well,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is it as mucky as it looks? I mean, does everything have to be cleaned every night?
Yeah, definitely. And when we rehearsed in it, we'd have to wash the fantastic ladies here in wardrobe. A whole specialised team, you know, came in to work really washing daily, several times a day, because we'd always wear the garments. Lots of versions. I've got 3 copies of everything, so that you can keep playing and getting muddy and having it washed again and did it again, all of that kind of thing. And for the lovers particularly, it's quite from a fresh, crisp, sort of clean Athenian garment to a mud drenched, look
very,
by the end. It's
their
very,
change is very clear.
Very,
yes.
Yeah, very clear.
Yeah.
And I think also, for example, we were concerned about lying in it a lot, because I have to lie in it for about 40 minutes generally.
With bottom,
but also before that, you know, all told. And it's actually curious, as it sort of warms up. So when you're in, it's really cosy. It's really nice. That was the thing we were dreading. I thought, oh no, we're going to have terrible rheumatism or something from being in this damp, sort of cold thing. And it just isn't like that. It's really strange. It's sort of... So all these things were unexpected. Walking in heels, and it was absolutely fine. Everyone's like, that's a nightmare. How are you going to do that? It's actually easier than wearing a pair of wellies. So next time, if you're concerned about heels in mud, you needn't be. That's the truth.
But what is it actually made of? I mean, we'll move on from this in a minute, but right, it's so
it
much part of
it
the
It is fascinating. It is actually a very
experience.
Specialised substance, and everyone has a sort of, a bit like people react to dry ice, they think, oh no, God, are we going to be coughing straight away with this? Mm. It's actually very sterilised. It's a sterilised substance that's used in Germany, I think, for, you know, mud treatments. So it's actually very good for you to be in it. So it's kind of holistic in lots of ways, very healthy, and the only thing I suppose is being slightly, it is slightly damp and it has to be watered down, and it's fantastic to you guys, deed up every day to so it kind of has to look, have a ploughed look at the start, and then by the end of the run it's really packed down and you know you
but
see.
But it's the same
mud is then
soil,
re-lifted.
Yeah.
The soil is re-energized.
I imagine
turned.
It would have to be replaced all
no,
the time.
Apparently
no.
not. It's never needed to be in other productions either. Even when it's been used many, many times, you have to clean before you go into it. You know, so your feet are kept. You don't bring muck into it. It's very careful, organized off stage, so that's the case. So it is. You know.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Very careful.
Well. Let's talk a little bit about the rehearsal process with Joe, because I mean, did you know when you started that was going to be an important component of
definitely.
It?
Yeah, you talked about that, and also the work with a mirror is very much from the word go. It's very
yes,
much
should, I should have said that. There's a mirror behind the stage area so that audience can see themselves reflected.
Yes, and. It's a very large mirror, and it's an integral sort of portal, really. It's being used in that way, as though beyond the mirror there is this other realm or another sense of yourself in another way. So your perception of yourself when you're working with a mirror is always quite complex, as you know, any way in life. But in rehearsal it's quite curious to see yourself having imagined what you're doing, and then you actually see yourself, is very, very different. It's quite shocking, actually, and it's quite hard to work with. But that's what is thrown up by using a mirror. It's very interesting. There's two different perspectives. The interior and the exterior start to become, you know, something you can play with. And in this case, Joe had a very strong idea that there were really scenes organised themselves into pairings a lot. Very much about couples experiencing, trying to work things out in love, in relationships. So this idea of looking at yourself, a double thing, and to double up characters, which is again, it's not uncommon, of course, but you know, to have Hippolyta and Titania, you know, doubled, mm-hmm. and Theseus and Oberon and so on, and Puck and Aegeus,
yes.
and also now. You know, it has a useful threshold anyway that we started to use very early on, that there is a transformation anyway between the real world and this other supernatural world via this portal of the mirror, which was quite an interesting clear way of looking at the idea of the supernatural or the magical world of fairies and so on. And the subconscious, and perhaps in another
Well,
time.
The worlds do get mixed up in this production a bit more than they normally would, even though we're used to Titania and Hippolyta and Oberon Theseus being doubled. At the end, I mean, Bottom seems to recognise Hippolyta, perhaps, as Titania.
Yeah.
And in fact, I thought the love scene between Bottom with the ass's head and Titania was really rather sweet and gentle, and because the rest of the lovers are having a lot of difficulty about committing, aren't they? Whereas these two, just for that time, seem rather sweetly together.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think Joe had a clear idea that what was curious. Well, there's lots of aspects to this. First of all, if you take the fairies away as such, which is what was one of the first choices, and I wasn't sure about it to start with, I found that's very important, the integral, the sort of sense of these, and that's very much attached to most productions, the sense of these creatures that are sort of innocent somehow, or they are playful, or they are, and he wanted to sort of strip that back and really look at that relationship and what actually transacted, and that in fact it is the most functioning relationship between pole opposites, which is what's interesting about it, where everything else, all other relationships, are really not working at all. They are getting very confused, and the lovers in this case, in our story, you know, really going mining into the text that's given, you know, they don't really come out of it in a very happy way. It's not an easy, comfortable resolution to their, you know, their loving of one another.
They're
it's
not even
in doubt.
They're not even physically together at the end, are they, the pairs? I mean,
yeah.
When they're discovered in the forest.
Yeah, that's right. You know, that was very carefully sort of explored through the text, you know, seeing really what's there and what's being transacted, the cruelty that they play towards one another. If that, you know, just what happens to that residue once they seem to come out of it, and one of them doesn't ever, you know, have the love juice sort of removed from his eyes, so to speak.
Mm.
He's always drugged up from the forever,
yes.
You
yes.
know.
Yeah.
So that's a bit dysfunctional, you know, in itself. So he was quite interested, Joe, in looking at that. So all these other relationships are brought on top of the problems that Hippolyta and Theseus have, having had a history of, in some versions, might be that he actually raped her. And then to have to join in a, you know, some sort of public role as a marriage in, you know, for you know, uniting two nations, for example, in a very political way, is not a comfortable place for a marriage to be.
She's certainly captured anyway, isn't she? She's
yeah,
sort of spoils
yeah.
of war.
Yeah, exactly. So if you look at that, and then Oberon and Titania, notoriously, the whole of the forest and all the other sort of supernatural creatures are terrified by the kind of arguments that they have. And you could see that as a very... a marriage in terrible crisis, actually, you know, rather than it being just a little problem over a little boy, you know. And so, yes, with all of that going on, the relationship between Bottom and Titania is rather extraordinary. Yeah, it's more pure in a sense, and they really do enjoy it. They actually find something rather wonderful together.
Yes.
And I think that's, yeah. That's
yes.
really was a choice.
Bottom will never be the same again.
No,
I think.
No, that's right.
But did you find parallels between Titania and Hippolyta? I mean, obviously the dysfunctional marriages or potential marriages in
yeah.
both cases. But what, are they similar in their response to their male partner? Do you think they're not? They're neither
no.
of them given to doing what they're told though, in this production, are they? If they can avoid it.
I think, well, Hippolyta is notoriously silent in first act 1-1, and all this
when Hermia is threatened.
Yes, and all the things that are happening for, you know, for an Amazonian to witness these strange Athenian behaviours towards their women. I you know, that's that. It's strange that there's nothing that she has to say, and she is restricted clearly and can't. So that's what we chose to do and play out. And in fact, we played the scene almost in the rehearsal process, very from the word go, with a series, for example, of games that meant we had a sole objective within that scene of just standing, sitting, or lying down, one person doing each of those things at any one time, but you could shift it and do whatever you want. So, but you. Only one person could do those things at a time. And these games had a way of drawing out physical shapes that otherwise you might not have expected. And for a silent character, it was very useful to realise that there's a lot going on for that character and how they might interact if they had the physical freedom to do that. With that kind of licence in a game like that, we started to realise that she was very active in that scene, but was, you know, not necessarily able to articulate it, and so that changed Hippolyta's,
that she can show her.
Yeah, she was pushing Theseus in
yes.
a sense, if you want this relationship to work, you're going to have to try and find a way of dealing with this Hermia problem, and he does offer up an alternative to death, which is the nunnery. But yeah, in terms of her relationship is kind of almost gagged, and so then you have Titania in Oberon, where it's obviously one of the most beautiful, longest and intense speeches that a female character has in Shakespeare sort of erupts from Titania there. Very, very different, and in a way, and I think that's, you know, the two things are deeply connected. If someone is silenced, and obviously yesterday was International Women's Day, and it's very interesting to be looking at these things again from that. If it will emerge somewhere, you know, you can't silence a woman's voice, and it will erupt. And that's in this story, that's where it seems to find voice. And the issue that they're arguing over is, in a way, his control of her and his wanting this boy regardless. Even if the planet is going to, you know, die, he still wants that boy from her.
Yes, and so, he's pretty cruel in what he does to her.
Yeah, yeah.
In order to control. But he doesn't have as much control over Puck as perhaps he might in some other guys,
yeah,
as well,
right.
Because Puck is very funny, played by Lloyd Hutchison.
It's a
chunky male with a red wig who doesn't really rush anywhere.
No,
and is quite sardonic about everything.
Yes, well, they go way back. I suppose that's the nature of any fool, isn't it, with a king, that they have license to do other things because they reflect back, you know, the worst and the best all the time, and they sort of, Oberon is, you know, it's his somehow there's always a lieutenant relationship, is that, you know, he's wanting, you know, he's vulnerable to him, which is unusual, isn't it?
Yes, so. Well, although we've seen other Pucks who are not skipping fairies in other productions, this one is against type too, but so is Bottom here.
Yeah.
It's very unusual, Bottom.
Mm.
Leo Bill.
Yeah.
He's sort of tall and skinny with very long hair and John Lennon glasses.
Yeah.
And he sings to you.
Yes. Yes.
Unexpectedly. And he's rather well spoken. He sounds a bit posh almost for a Bottom.
Okay. I think he's he had quite a journey with Mechanicals, finding a very, very serious and earnest relationship with trying to tell this, to do the play.
Yes.
And they develop characters who, you know, they, a theatre group working on trying to make a play, you know, to the nth degree. It's and it becomes eventually life and death. It's very, if they get it wrong, they could be hanged.
Yes.
So it's not just, they found beautiful backstories and lives for each of these characters. So they exist really immaculately, and their relationship with one another is so dependent, and it's the sort of shining light of human interaction, what you can achieve if you stick together and try and, you know, be creative. And the whole process of making a play is really entrenched in this play, within a play. You know, it's we all know as actors and performers just how much is at stake when you do it and try and do it well. And so the characters that they found are, you know, deeply earnest and willing to throw everything. Maybe they have in common that women perhaps are not much in their sphere, for example. I haven't gone into his backstory a huge amount, you know, that's something, that's his own thing, but a lot of people think of him as a kind of a roadie, you know, man who, you know, and it doing these plays is really the most important thing in their lives, their amdram work, if you like, if you know, and that is the case, you know, one's experience of those things, you know, as a child I remember being involved, and the people who were doing it, running them, it's fantastically significant. I mean, we worked with so many people like that, you know.
Did you all work together in rehearsals so that you shared
We did. We worked really from the day one, off text, straight in. It was not no table work at all. A lot of physical improvisations that went on for hours, actually, sometimes. Very carefully orchestrated. So we'd be looking at almost effectively an act and running through that with various things, you know, goals in mind. Every character was set objectives within that, and then they would run and they would take the time that they took to when we would explore what these, and so by doing the play, doing the text, we would find out what the play was, which is quite challenging because it's quite exhausting, and it's very revealing for yourself because you're putting the it's like I'm being under hypnosis with a, you know, sometimes those magicians will tease someone when they're under hypnosis and get them to sort of play like a dog or do something ridiculous. It was a bit like that sometimes. So you find yourself in these situations and positions that just if you'd thought about it, you would have never have attempted, you know, or you wouldn't have even imagined you would do. So that, in a sense, is kind of... really interesting about the process, although it was difficult, it wasn't easy.
And you don't leave at all, so that you're
so everyone was in all the time, and in rehearsals pretty well that was the case too. Sometimes we'd go off and split up. The lovers would be a group, the fairies would be a group, the mechanicals, so there are these different kind of teams at various points, but basically always all together, which is amazing. It does create a huge focus and intensity because you're being witnessed all the time. It ups the ante as much as the audience being there, because the audience, you know, they get a new, you know, they get one show. It could be the same every night, but you can't do that when everyone's there. You can't replicate anything, because it's like, seen that, done that. What's she doing now? Same old, you know. Keep moving on.
Well, I thought it was remarkable that I quite often, you know, didn't notice that, for instance, you were changing from Titania back to Hippolyta. I mean, you know, and of course that happened around the stage with people doing this sort of thing, getting ready for things and so on. But you managed to keep the focus very well on what the audience is supposed to be looking at, despite the fact that everyone's there.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I think that's different people. They some people felt that they needed more lighting states that would focus. But I think once you know that's the case. Our ear goes to the sound, goes to the voice, and you know who's leading a scene principally. And I think quickly people adapt it. They have to work a little harder than it just being spoon fed. I don't think that's ever a bad thing. It's like, you know, when you say we don't have objects. So, you know, there is a bottle. There is some script papers,
a pair of tights,
and some
bits
and bobs for him, which is carried on, and that's it. The rest is, you know, we imagine, you imagine, and that allows you in a way. Sometimes it is always the virtue of that. If you're not given everything, then this is a larger breadth of possibility rather than it being sort of stamped and specified. And so sometimes that really opens up an audience's perspective and, you know, perceptions of things, and I think that's good. I think that does happen. But as you said, for you it was fine. I think sometimes people do find it challenging having all those bodies. But we also look very carefully at things, which helps guide the eye too. Things like that, quite curious how simple that can be. If everyone's doing that, then it's quite apparent that's where you need to be looking.
Yes, before the play, within the play, of course, some of the mirror has to be obscured, doesn't it?
Right. I think that was also a sense that, you know, that other world is blocked off now. It's a kind of, as if Oberon's trick didn't quite do, it sort of, it backfired on him because... And, it, you know, he expected to be punishing her and getting her to give back the changeling, and that would all be fine. She'd be back under his control somehow, or, you know, she was his lady again. But, you know, having discovered that she actually really enjoyed it, it's sort of a humiliation for him, really. Mm. So it didn't work out quite as... So that kind of, well, you know, from the Theseus perspective, Mike had a view very much that Theseus was, you know, a man in crisis, who his Oberon through
this
the...
This is Michael Gould.
Michael Gould. His Oberon through the mirror, if you like, on the other side, was somebody who was trying to resolve this crisis that he had in a relationship in the real world. So if he didn't succeed in getting control of... on the subconscious level, he was going to seal that world up.
That was it, in a sense.
There's more to it than I had realised.
Well, that's interesting.
I suppose you could take it in lots of ways, and we didn't analyse that either, and there's lots of, you know, one day we came in and it was painted over, and it was kind of, you know, we're now definitely in the real world from that point on.
Hmm.
I mean, you can take from those emblems what you want. I don't think Joe or certainly Johannes Schutz wanted to kind of...
The designer
wanted to kind of dictate what you should take from that.
Right. The music, especially at the beginning, is unexpectedly beautiful. I mean, you have this wonderful Latin choral singing while you're all standing in the mud. I mean...
Yeah. It's about triumph, that. It's a sort of victory song. And in a sense, that's where Athens is. It's seemingly at its zenith, you know, having won over the Amazonian. That war, which had gone on for a long time, is over. So hooray! You know, it starts off, and it, and things seem to kind of slightly collapse from there. Really, but it is a great piece, beautiful. Melanie Pappenheim, you know, she worked with us on and had a fantastic repertoire of sounds and music and different sorts of songs, but also in terms of working with everybody and developing their voices to do all the things required in the play. And there is a small choir that is developing, and we feel like we're ready for performance of some other works by the end of this.
Oh my goodness, that's exciting.
She's absolutely amazing.
Well, it sounded really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely down to that sort of work. And a very, very musical group, tremendous, you know, really fantastic company. You know, all the different kinds of skills that you don't always obviously hear. You can, some of the characters are, you know, they're not verbally very sort of, you know, significant, but they are enormous characters, and that's what makes a production work, is if the life of those characters is full, if not more full than seemingly the ones who get all this text. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of make or break for me when I watch shows. I always end up looking at the waiters going, or you know, finding out what's happening on the periphery, the things that's seemingly not very important and really far more important. That's where the life seems to be.
Yeah.
And that's no more, I'm so pleased to say, you know, this fantastic, extraordinary group of actors are, you know, really brilliant in all spheres, and music being another one. So
yes. Sam Cox is someone I particularly noticed, having seen him many times before.
Yeah.
He's starveling in this. He hasn't got a very big role.
Yeah.
But
he's
a very, very funny person.
Yeah, he is deeply. And, very great in the show.
Yes. Well, this must be unlike any other Shakespeare you've ever done, the approach to it. You're more used to going, sitting and looking at the text first, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. It seems to be standard fare, doesn't it, really? Well, Cheek by Jowl isn't so much like that.
No,
with Declan Donald.
No, that Macbeth was extraordinary too, in a very different way, because...
Yeah.
Again, the audience had to use their imagination a lot and be taken into the play in a different way.
Yeah, I think their process is very much, because they are touring shows, and you know, they really pare back stuff in a similar way, and they have always done that. that particular production, yeah, there was nothing, you know. And the idea of imaginary blood is, again, with certain things like that, is so much more powerful. I mean, you could never produce the amount of blood that there is in the imagination when a murder takes place. Otherwise, it sort of becomes, you know, in that sense, just people living with the idea of something horrific. And it is so much about the being overwhelmed by your imagination after the fact. In that place right there. So anyway, but yeah, their process is definitely not about round a table, and working on it as you know as the text inspires from the word go. And it is amazing how much you know about a play the first time you read it, and you often spend most of your time trying to just get back there from the word go. So, you know, I think that is probably a better process, certainly with Shakespeare.
Well, you're obviously enjoying it.
It's brilliant. I mean, it's brilliant fun with this particular group. Yeah, amazing. So, yeah.
It's sort of, as I think everyone expected, divided the critics, but some people really loved it
and some people just didn't. Yeah.
But you knew that was going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think anyone thought for a minute it was going to be a sort of easy ride. But you know, you have to experiment with things, and the joy of something like Shakespeare is, you know, it's just so resilient. Of course, it's the more you try, the better, really. And the joy of this one as well, being at the Young Vic, being, you know, the young folk who do see it, respond to it so strongly, you know, as your first production. It might not be a typical one, but it's one that they can't quite believe how much they enjoyed. You know, it's like, I didn't realise it could be like this, you know.
Yeah.
And
you do get young audiences here,
don't
you?
Yeah, very much so. Mm. You know, sometimes the other day we had 300 kids in one show, and that, I guess that's the same a lot, you know, at the Globe and RSC. But it's it's a great one for young people. And equally, we found elderly people particularly really. I think the cynicism in there is something very. That resounds a lot as you get older in life. I think I feel that, you know, I don't have expectations of flowers and fairies in quite the same way I might have done put it that way. So
and the lovers are deliberately cast slightly older than,
yes, I think, because again, you know, they wanted to have that life history that could really generate those very, very bleak images of cruelty and hatred. There's things they say, some of them are just despicable. I mean, you just, that would be the end of a relationship, some of the things that are said, and yet they do have to seem to come through it and come out the other end. And so, yeah, an older set of actors, in a sense, with that experience, do deliver a different and, you know, very rich energy in those characters, because they can often really go for a Burton, and it's just a bit of a, you know, a bit, oh, it's a bit silly and funny, you know, they turn around, they don't love each other, they love each other, oh well, and then it's all fine in the end. You know, I don't know, it just seems to go for nothing. So it is an interesting variant to actually really get in there in the mudslinging.
But indeed. Well, thank you very much for talking about being in it, because it seems to have been quite an experience.
Yeah.
And how long have you got still to do?
Just at the end of the month, so really
another 2.5 weeks
or
something.
Yeah, exactly.
Good. And then what?
Oh, gosh. Well, I very rarely know more than a couple of weeks before, or months, really. And I'm doing an adaptation of Elena Ferrante's My Best Friend? No, My Brilliant Friend. I get it very clean. So that's the next thing I'm working on, but for the radio.
Right. There is a stage production of that
on
the moment, isn't there?
Which is now sort of... We've been doing this one over a sort of period of since last summer, so that's kind of, we're ahead of them. But
yes,
you know,
got there
it
first.
It was a question of time before somebody was going to do it, because it's so brilliant.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Good.